Hey everybody, we're going to do something a little bit different this episode. Instead of going through every single package installed on a Slackware Linux install disk, I'm going to talk about some listener feedback that I got from my friend Deep Geek, who you'll know if you've listened to this show for any length of time, or for that matter, to Hacker Public Radio. Deep Geek wrote a fairly long message, and usually when people write me email messages, it usually gets me thinking, and then I start talking, and then a show is the result, or an episode rather. So that's I think what's going to happen here. Could be wrong. Maybe it'll be brief. I don't know, but it's already probably taken me a minute to introduce the concept, so that's not a good sign. Okay. Let's jump right into this email. He says, I just love the Firefox browser. As far as I know, it is the only browser that supports multiple cookie jars. So as you know, cookies are important for tracking users. Just by pressing a few clicks for strict tracking protection, Firefox isolates third-party cookies and blocks tracking cookies based on a database of known trackers. When I say isolates, I mean that the third-party cookies that one website put into your browser is separated out when you go to another website. If you go to a second website that puts a third-party cookie into your browser from the same tracker, Firefox actually has two cookies for the same tracker, one for each site. So the tracking organization doesn't see that you have visited both sites. They see two browsers instead. The process isolation is so good, in fact, that if you use the add-on for multi-account containers, you can sign on to the same website under different accounts in different tabs. And when you tell Firefox to forget that it visited a certain site, it deletes those third-party cookies instead associated with the site you told Firefox to forget about. So you're not getting some random phantom cookies lying around. Okay, so that's the first segment of the email. This is Klaatu again, and that was Deep Geek. Now I'm speaking as Klaatu. He's spot on right about this. I mean, this is one of the primary reasons I use Firefox. It is such a nice feature. I don't think it's a default feature yet for the multi-account containers. I've had it installed for such a long time at this point that for all I know, it could have been rolled into a default install. I don't think it is. And I mean, Deep Geek himself says it's an add-on. So if he's checked lately, then that's two votes that, yeah, possibly this is something you have to add on to your Firefox. But it is very, very worth it. If you're not running this add-on in Firefox, if you're not running Firefox, you should try both of those things, Firefox and it's the Firefox multi-dash account containers. That's the name of the add-on. So if you go into your extensions for Firefox and search for multi-dash account containers, then, and I'll put a link to its little homepage in the show notes, because it's really, really good. It's amazing. My partner actually turned me on to this. She uses it for a lot of her, because she separates out, you know, obviously, well, not obviously, but a work profile from a personal profile, especially for social media posting. She needs to have sort of that clear separation. And so she's been using this for even longer than I have. But she turned me on to this, and it's amazing. It comes up as a in the little plugin area on your browser. And when you click it, you can create containers within Firefox. So you could have a work container, you could have a personal life container, you could have a financial life container, you could have a gaming profile, you know, all the different things that you do on the internet that you might want to separate out from each other. And that's exactly how it gets used, because then you can open up a site while at work. You could open up your work email or your work's collaboration suite or whatever in one tab, and then have another tab for some other profile with another account somewhere, and then another tab, and so on. So, and you can literally, you can sign into the same site just in a different tab in the same Firefox window. And the tabs are color-coded. They get a little line at the top according to whatever color you chose for that container. So you can tell pretty easily. Better yet, Firefox, or rather multi-account containers, eventually starts to learn what sites quote unquote belong to which container. Now that can be a little bit troublesome because, you know, if it's a site that you go to for more than one reason, like let's say you've got a YouTube account and your YouTube account you use both for your personal life to post videos or to watch videos, whatever. But you also use it at work because you have to post stuff for work or something. Then, you know, the multi-account containers will never truly know which profile you want YouTube, or more specifically, the Gmail account that you have to use to sign into YouTube. It won't know whether you want to do, you know, that action. It won't know whether that's a work action or a personal action. But even in that case, it prompts you. It says, like, you know, this site has... is you usually open up this site in, you know, your work profile. Is that what you want to do? Or do you want to open it in the current container that you're in right now? So if you open it up in a site that you don't normally open it in, then it sort of flags that and asks you to whether you want to proceed or to open it into in the other container. And it's not doing that. It's not like when I say learning, it's not using any fancy algorithm here. It's just literally when you go to a site and tell it to open it in a different container, that gets earmarked as belonging to that container. And I believe you can reassign things. Actually, yeah, even when it warns you, I think you can say, like, remember this for next time if you want to, like, no, I didn't mean to ever open this up in my personal. This is really just a work account thing. Assign it to the work container. So it'll still get confused sometimes. It's not flawless, but I mean, when I say it's confused, it's just one step between going, you know, it's one step on the path of opening something in a different container. The way to get around that step is to just go to the account, the multi-account container button in the upper right of Firefox and open a new tab in the container that you want to open it to use, and then go to the site. So it's either, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's not a big deal. You can also reopen a site. So if you go to a site, you're there, like, I don't know, GitHub or something, you log into that and you think, oh, I didn't actually mean to do that. I need to reopen this in my work account. And so then you it just opens that. You'll have to sign in again, of course, because that's the point of the containers, right? It's isolating everything. But you can just, like, swap out a tab if you want. So that's the multi-account container feature of Firefox. I think it's like an officially supported add-on, but it is just not included in the default download of Firefox, probably because it's considered a quote-unquote advanced feature, I imagine, and they just don't want to confuse people. But it is really, really nice. If you are at all interested in privacy, then absolutely, absolutely, you need to try that. Firefox multi-account containers. Okay, Deep Geek continues. What does this have to do with your last show? You mentioned those weird, unique numbers in the Firefox profile manager. Those are actually hashes of entire installations. So to give an example, I just installed Firefox from the Void repository. He uses Void Linux. Back to Deep Geek here. And Firefox kept track of the difference between the Flatpak installs and the install done with the Void installation system. I can manually open one profile with the other Firefox install, but I don't want to, and Firefox lets them live side by side. Lastly, with profiles, I just figured out how enterprise installation works with Firefox. I now have an institutional policy so that no matter how many profiles I create, I get the same exact pre-installed add-ons and the same security settings. Okay, this is Klaatu. I didn't know about that. I don't know what he's talking about. The profile thing, I hear what he's saying. I don't buy it. And here's why I don't buy it. I buy what he's saying. I think he's correct. I believe he's correct. I'm pretty darn sure he's correct. I just don't buy that that's the only way we could do this could achieve this functionality. And I feel like a lot of times in computing, there's a sort of a principle to things. And one principle is things need to be sort of automatically generated and look and feel random. And that way we can ensure that there will never be any collision in namespaces. You see the same kind of argument with Flatpak, to be honest. People have been saying for years now, Flatpak needs better naming schemes. Once again, I've complained about this several times, but I may as well do it again. Let's search for, here's my favorite example, for no good reason, it's not anybody's fault, but Flatpaks. But if I do a Flatpak search GIMP, G-I-M-P, of course there is a Flatpak containing GIMP, the GIMP name in it, and one of those is org.gimp.gimp. And that's the name that you're supposed to use when referring to what you and I colloquially call, is it colloquially? That's its name, right? GIMP or GNU Image Manipulation Program. But you're not allowed, you can't, in Flatpak world, you can't say that. You can't say, I want to install GIMP. You have to say, I want to install org.gimp. Capital G, capital I, capital M, capital P. That's stupid. And I understand the argument for that, because that's a unique, sort of fully qualified, unique name. No one else in the Flatpak world can now call their application org.gimp.gimp. Fair enough. Let's look for another one. Here's Pulsar, I think is what it's called. Nope. Pulsar? Yeah. Pulsar. This is the Atom editor, and actually, is this the one? No, that's not the one. Sorry, I'm thinking of VS Codeium, maybe. Yeah, I think this is the one I'm thinking about. No, actually, that's not it either. I don't know what I'm thinking about. There is one out there. There's an editor out there that you can install through Flatpak, but it's a quote-unquote unofficial Flatpak. In other words, it's not. It isn't distributed by the developers of the application. And so the address of the Flatpak doesn't contain, it isn't the official, it doesn't use the fully qualified domain name of the development website, because it's not coming from there. It uses probably, I don't know, an io.github.username.whatever application I'm thinking of URL. So you can tell from the application ID itself whether this is like from the developers, as long as you know the official website name. In reverse, you can tell whether this is from the developers or whether it is from someone who happens to have packaged an application up for Flatpak, because it's open source software and you're allowed to do that. So there's the unique ID of that thing, and I guess the fear within Flatpak is that someone could develop, create a malicious version of the application GIMP or Pulsar or VS Codeium or whatever, and someone would accidentally install it by just typing in Flatpak install malicious app. And they you'd never know the difference. I mean, you wouldn't type malicious app. You'd type GIMP, or you'd type Pulsar or VS Codeium. Those are the things that you would type. And then because there's no unique identifier, you're just subject to this sort of common one term that might not be the correct one. What's that got to do with this profile manager thing? Well, I think that's kind of the same logic, is that, well, we have to have like these ridiculous, very human unfriendly naming schemes for fear of somehow colliding with the same name somewhere else. And I'm not convinced that that's the thing that could happen. You can build other systems around your thing to protect from that kind of eventuality. I mean, you could insist that yes, you can have a human-friendly name, but we're going to tag a random string at the end of it, no matter what, because we need to keep it completely unique. Or you could say, well, we will only ever look at the name of your profile up to the first underscore, and after the underscore, you can have whatever human-friendly naming scheme you want to have yourself. We'll ignore that. We're just looking at that first part of the name, or whatever. You could say there could be a key within the profile, so that if someone wants to rename their profile something that they'll recognize, then you're not even looking at the name. You're looking at the key within that directory. I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it. I don't really understand this idea of sort of over complex, quote unquote, guaranteed to be unique naming schemes. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm not buying the weird unique numbers in the profile manager names. I don't think that that's a smart way to do it. I could be wrong. I'm no expert, but seems to me like that's you could get around that. Okay, so anyway, and I understand that, you know, things are created before people name them. So how do you get around that? And like I say, there are ways. We all know there are ways to just design around inconveniences. But, you know, I mean, someone would have to do that design. They would have to program it. It would have to, and certainly now Firefox has a long time of backwards compatibility to be concerned about. So I get it. I get it. I just don't like it. But those profiles are great. I mean, DeepGeek is spot on about their advantages and how well they work and how they truly, truly isolate sort of your user identity. I've taken advantage of these quite often, not really for myself, but when transferring data on client computers. It's really handy for that sort of thing. The one thing I dislike about this also, though, is that Firefox does tend to change profiles in an irreversible way should you update your Firefox version and then try to go back to an older profile, if you update your Firefox application and then you decide, I don't really like this new version, I'm going to just go back to the other version, then Firefox basically can't, very frequently, it can't go back, it can now no longer use your profile. You have updated your profile and now you are out of luck. You cannot use that profile with an older version because the older version, you know, for whatever reason, just can't handle the fact that there's like some, you know, one new data field or whatever the difference is. So that can be inconvenient. That's caught me out a couple of times where I'll go to a nightly build or to a flat pack because I want to try the flat pack. And then I decide, no, I'd rather just use a system install, but then the system install is lagging behind the flat pack or whatever the scenario. And that's a real problem, I think. So whenever I'm messing around too much with profiles in Firefox, I generally make a backup of the profile. Okay, DeepGeek continues. Firefox users get an extra bonus. The guys at the Tor project, they don't want to write their own browser, so they submit patches to Firefox instead. So if you want a Firefox profile that acts like a Tor browser, but not on the Tor network, all you have to do is search for the Tor Uplift project and toggle on a new feature written by the super privacy-minded Tor folk for Firefox. So that's really, really cool. I didn't know about this one. This is new to me, and I haven't had a chance to try this yet. I will say, though, that that's one thing that I do notice about my internet usage is that on Firefox. I mean, I only use Firefox unless there's some site that, for whatever reason, insists that I use Chrome or something like that. And even then, do I have Chromium these days, or do I just use Chrome? Yeah, it looks like I do have Chrome. I think that might have been, is that installed with Firefox? I don't even know where that came from, or not Firefox, Slackware. I don't know where it came from, but that's what I've got installed on my system right now. Usually I try to use Chromium, but I guess in this case, it must have been easier for me to just have Chrome or something. Or maybe there was something that literally I needed Chrome for. I don't remember. It's been ages now, and I probably should just actually probably uninstall that so that I can update it if I'm going to go that route. But anyway, Firefox is really my, you know, certainly my daily driver, and anything else would be an exception to the rule. And I've faltered a little on Firefox. You know, for a little while, Firefox was, I think, struggling maybe or something, because I was having serious problems with it, and I did switch to Chromium for like maybe a couple of months. And it's just, I don't know, it's not super satisfying, especially knowing, I mean, Chromium, you know, there's satisfaction there because it is open source. So, you know, at least that things are, that the development is happening from lots of places and multiple people are benefiting from that process. Chrome, not very satisfying at all. But Firefox is it's a really, really robust application is the thing. I mean, it is a powerful application, and I don't really love web browsers in theory. And yet Firefox is really, really well done. It's got a lot going for it. It's a really nice browser. It's got amazing add-ons. There's a lot to like about Firefox, and certainly about Mozilla, at least what they, the Mozilla Foundation, what they support. So lots going for it. So that's what I use. And what I have found is that in the best of cases, it just doesn't seem like websites know who I am. And most websites seem to think that I'm visiting their site for the first time. And I'll admit, like, there are some days where I just think this is just so stupid because I've been here 20 times. I come here every morning. I go to this website or whatever, and then I realize that the fact that that's happening is actually kind of a good sign. I mean, apparently my trackability and sort of browser cookie retention policy and all these other things is so bad, good, that websites specifically designed to cater to your personalized experience, they just don't, they can't, they don't have that ability. And in today's world, that's bizarrely kind of a comforting thing. It's kind of nice to know that my configuration and the browser that I'm running is sufficiently confounding to all of the very high-tech data tracking and data retention policies that websites have, that no matter where I go, it just seems like I have to reintroduce myself every single time. Does that mean a lot more clicks sometimes? I mean, it depends on how bad the website is. Like sometimes websites, they'll have 20 different pop-ups that you have to get through in order to tell you what region you're in, to tell the website what region you're in and whether you're okay with their cookie policy, which you're probably not. But I mean, these days it doesn't matter apparently because I'm just going to ditch them after I'm done. So yeah, I didn't necessarily set out to go sort of privacy conscious, interestingly, with Firefox, but I think either I'm compelled to configure things that way anyway, sort of without thinking about it, or maybe, I mean, you have to think about it, but I don't know that I was sitting down thinking, well, I need to be anonymous online. I had better go and change everything. This is something that I think I've developed rather organically. And that's not to sort of pat myself on the back. Like, that's just a choice that I'm making. And like I say, that there's good and bad to it. I mean, like, in one sense, yeah, it's great because now I feel like I'm anonymous online. Big deal. On the other hand, I have to click several times every single time I go to a website, sometimes even in the same day. Whether that's an experience that a modern user really wants or needs to have is up for debate. I'm not going to say that everyone needs to be anonymous online all the time. I don't even need to be anonymous online all the time. I mean, sometimes I do want a website to know who I am. It's fine. I don't care. It's like if you know that I play role-playing games and that I purchase role-playing game products, that's okay. I don't mind that. I'll have to figure out how to let everyone know that, but certainly the web browser doesn't seem to, or the web doesn't seem to know. But the cool thing here is, so I'm not patting myself on the back necessarily for saying, oh, look how privacy conscious I am. I'm actually just saying that if that's the route you want to go, then Firefox will support you in that. And that's important, that the tool of your choice isn't going to sort of stand in your way, certainly. I mean, that would be a deal breaker for me. But it does happen. I mean, there are absolutely software tools out there that when you decide that you want to try something, the software is literally designed to not let you do the thing. And like that's the worst, right? That is worst case scenario, I think, is when an application or a whole vendor is literally designed to prevent you from pursuing something on your computer that you want to pursue. That's just the worst thing. I mean, unless it's something horrible and really, really bad. I mean, okay, I get it. Like, obviously, you wouldn't. I'm not going to design a tool that will just circumvent, I don't know, logging into a secure site. Like, yes, you're still going to have to type in your passwords, and I'm still going to encrypt that traffic. I get that, but like, in terms of like choices that you want to make on how you use your computer in a bubble, a tool should not prevent you from doing that. Firefox doesn't prevent you from doing that sort of thing. Firefox supports you in the choices that you make on how you want to interact with the big wide world out there. And that's important. I mean, the internet is a crazy place. It's like the real world. I mean, it is the real world. It's there's a lot of different things happening there, lots of different agendas, and you need the ability to opt in. Everything on the internet needs to be consensual, and if your tool is not letting that happen, then that's a bad sign, and you shouldn't have to hack around it in order to get to opt into something or to opt out of something. That should be something that is made clear and relatively simple to comprehend by the tool that you are using. And that for me is Firefox, and that I think is one of its key advantages. And I've said so on several little surveys that Mozilla has sent out. Like that component right there. And interestingly, I think that component is broadly called privacy, which we've all had the problem with the definition of privacy, right? Because people say things, we all say it, we all think it sometimes, we don't need privacy, we're not interesting enough for people to like spy on, quote unquote. And we've had great explanations of why that is not sort of, that's not the primary concern. So it's a complex term, privacy, but that's the term that we're using, I guess. And I think for me, almost interestingly, I don't think it's about privacy as much as it is about consent, opting in and opting out. Like, yes, that falls under privacy, or maybe privacy falls under it, I'm not sure. I just don't think that the term privacy encompasses everything about the concern here. And I think the real concern is just how your tool presents options available to you when you're interacting with the internet. That's a really important concept, because if it doesn't give you the options, if it hides those options, if it actively works against those options, then as a user, you may not even know it's a concern. And so you're being duped. And that's just not why we're using computers. We want agency for everyone. And I think Firefox really is kind of the only browser still so far that has truly demonstrated that that's their agenda, that they don't have like an ulterior, like, we would really prefer to track you agenda, or we're working with vendors to help them track you better agenda, or just we see what you want to do, we'll let you do that, we'll help you build this online profile or have your own agenda on how you want to interact with the internet. We won't stand in the way. I think Firefox is really the only browser that can kind of make that claim still to this day. And that's a crazy statement, because Firefox has been around for a long time. So for them to have held fast for this long is kind of amazing. And also, lots of other browsers have come and gone, and they've each had the same ability to sort of step into that role. And instead, they pretty much, they very frequently sort of go in other directions. Chromium's probably a good exception, and there are plenty of perfectly acceptable browsers based on Chromium. I'm just going to say that in terms of interface and making it really simple for people to opt in and opt out of things and sort of manage their own identities, I think Firefox is among the best. All right, back to DeepGeek. Should we have coffee? Yeah, we should have coffee, and then we'll come back to DeepGeek's email, finish up their episode. Okay, we're back, and I've got coffee, and it's a new coffee. It's not the summertime blend from Flight Coffee. This is a coffee from a place called Stone House Cottage, I think is what it's called. And I was taken there. I went there with someone else. And when I first was on the way, the name Stone House Orchard or whatever it's called, cottage, made me think that the building would be stone. And indeed it was. When I got there, it was a stone, literally a stone cottage. And it's a cafe. So, or primarily a cafe. And I mean, they have amazing food and amazing coffee, which is obviously why I bought a bag of their coffee beans. But I also found out while I was there that they have an orchard in the back. And because of the time of year here in New Zealand, you could go pick your own cherries. So we did that. So we picked about a kilo of cherries, and I think I must have eaten them in at least, I mean, it might have been a full week, but I think it's more like 5 days. It was so good, and a lot of fun to pick your own cherries. I mean, it's work. People get paid to do it, but I mean, instead, I paid someone else so I could do it. And it was really fun. It was good. It was lots of cherries, very good. And the coffee was great. And so the sequence of events was that we had lunch, really good sandwich, cup of coffee, and an amazing cinnamon roll, American style cinnamon roll. It was so good. And then we went to pick cherries and walked through the gardens, came back into the cafe because by that time I was thinking I should get another cup of coffee. And then the corollary thought to that was I should get a bag of the coffee beans so that I can have lots more cups of coffee at home. And I did that. And yeah, it's really, really good. It's like, I guess the guy at the cafe said that it was like a prize winning blend or something like that. It's super good. And I was pondering the flavor profile of this. And as you know, if you've listened to previous episodes, flavor profiles are something that I'm kind of struggling with lately because I'm realizing that we don't have specialized language for it, or at least that I know of. I mean, there may be among the people who, I don't know, think about flavors a lot, but for me, in common language, I don't know of a way to describe a flavor outside of just similes. You know, you say, oh, this coffee is sort of bright, like, and has a subtle flavor of sort of like apricot, you know, and that's how we describe a coffee. That doesn't seem accurate. Obviously, coffee doesn't actually taste like apricot. So what's the element within the apricot flavor that we're tasting in the coffee? What is that? What's that called? And in music, you do have terms. You know, you can say, oh, that's a treble note. That's a bass note. That has vibrato and all these other things. But in flavor, I don't think you have that. Or maybe you do, like I said, and I just don't know what they are. But anyway, I was thinking about the coffee. This is not an apricot flavored, or, you know, this doesn't have any notes of apricot in it. But what it does have is that sort of really dark, almost burned coffee, you know, that sort of dark roast. It's got a hint of that, but uniquely that hint of that flavor, it's more of a I don't know if it's quite an aftertaste, but it's the thing that you taste, you know, sort of after you've savored the coffee for a little bit, and then you realize, oh, there's a little bit of a dark roast in there, but it doesn't taste like a dark roast. It's not like a full-on slam you with a truck of dark roast coffee beans. It's like a smooth coffee. Oh, wait, and is that a little bit of a dark roast in there in the background? Why, yes, it is. It's an amazing coffee. I've never quite experienced anything quite like that before, I don't think. So this is a good one. It is from Stonehouse Cottage, I'm pretty sure is what it's called. Oh, yeah, so, sorry. So I meant to finish that story, too. So the point of Stonehouse. It is a stone building, and there are other stone buildings on that property. But the reason it's called Stonehouse is because they grow cherries, apricots, plums, maybe peaches, I don't know. But these kinds of fruit, as I have come to learn, I think I might have known this, but they're called sometimes stone fruit, I guess because they have a big old seed in them, like a single, you know, very hard seed at the center. And so they call them stone fruit. I don't know that I knew that. I might have, but people were talking about it like it was super obvious on the day. And it took me a long time to catch on that that's, oh, stone house, like stone fruit house, not a house made of stone. Although both were true. So in my own defense, I wasn't wrong. Okay, let's move on with this email. So Deep Geek says, I recently ended up with a little mini PC. So he's moving on from Firefox now. He says, I recently ended up with a little mini PC from a project I like to call my Roku server. I leave this baby running 24/7 and thus no longer use my big computer for serving the household Rokus. Since my big computer idles at 70 watts and this little guy idles at 6 watts, this is my way of being green. I used a KVM switch for the install. It can get confusing to remember which computer you're using, so here are a few tips. The pre-login screen for consoles, the one that says something like void Linux on TTY3, is controlled by a file called /etc/ issue. Now that the name of the system is known, you can do a web search for Linux /etc/issue sequences, as in escape sequences, and add all kinds of information to your pre-login screen. This really helps when keep track of when which computer screen is actively your screen is actively showing you. As far as using SSH, once you have it all installed, I'd like to suggest a little add-on for the .bashrc file after installing the package neofetch. Okay, so first I'm going to do a quick look. Yep, DeepGeek appears to be correct. If you do a cat on /etc/issue, you see welcome to /s/r/m /l /. Don't know what any of that means, I can guess, but I think he's probably correct. If you just do an internet search for /etc/issue, you'll probably find a bunch of cool little sequences that you could have your computer say to you when you get to a non-graphical login screen. So that's cool to know. I don't know that I knew that. So then he says, he's saying with install NeoFetch, and then you have a cool hack for SSH stuff. So here it is. Echo a bunch of dashes, uname-n. What is that? Uname-n. Let's find out really quick. Uname-n is the your full local domain, or node name is what they call it. --node name is what they say in the man page. Okay, so NeoFetch, memory uptime distro. I don't think I have NeoFetch installed. I know the application. I do have it installed. Oh, that is nice. Memory, it tells you how much memory you've got. Uptime, shows you your uptime. Distro, shows you your distro. Oh, I like that. That is very cool. I like that a lot. Let's see, where else am I here? I've lost my place. NeoFetch, and then echo-in terminal, --, tty, pipe, cut-d, /-f, 3-4. What could that be? I don't know. Oh, echo-in. Okay, so terminal :pts /1 is the current TTY that you're on, and then echo --. So basically he's giving you a bunch of information about the system. So with this, when you log in with SSH, between two rows of dashes followed with the display is the name of the system, the NeoFetch summary of memory uptime and distro, and lastly the name of the TTY you are on, and then the bash cut command removes all the /dev stuff and so on. So yeah, that is really useful. I'll be honest. So this is Klaatu again, and that's the end of the email. I'll be honest, what I do lately, and this is what we used to do at the digital visual effects house that I used to work at here in New Zealand in Wellington. And there, it always felt a little bit grandiose. And then you realize, no, actually, that's really, really useful. And like a lot of things, it has the strange ability of kind of fading into the background once you get used to it, which of course makes it again less useful. But here's what I do. So my bash prompt is preceded by a line displaying the history number of that of where I am in my bash history, the host name, the host IP, the directory that I'm in, the Git branch that I'm in, what version of Python I'm running, and what version of Java I'm running. And I'll explain each of those and why I would do that. And so in other words, I'll type in clear here. So I'm looking at my console, my KDE terminal, and I see a line 518, blah, blah, directory, Git, Python, Java. And then under that, there's a $ space, and that's where I put all of my commands. And then once I hit enter, I'll do an ls. Okay, there's my stuff. And then 519, blah, IP, directory, Git, Java, Python, or Python, Java. And then next line, $ space. So every bash prompt I have is effectively two lines. There's the line about everything, and then there's a blank line with a $. And the reason I do this is because I know that a lot of people have, like, they have their prompt update itself every time they move into a new directory, or it shows them their username at their host name and then their directory. And that to me is, I can't stand that. I want my bash prompt as far to the left as possible, but I've lately I have come to realize that it does save me commands if I have a certain amount of information on screen at all times. And because the bash terminal can sort of fly away into nothingness pretty quickly, you know, if you list the contents of slash temp, I mean, there, my whole screen is now useless to me. But all I have to do is look down at the bottom of it, and now I've got all that information again. Exactly what directory I'm in, whether I'm in a Git branch, and so on. So having that line of sort of a summary is pretty darn useful, I have found. And having like the history number, well, that's great, because that way if I'm doing a sequence of commands and I get one wrong and I have to sort of backtrack, then, you know, unless they are all listing the slash tmp directory that clears my screen and fills it with names of useless files, I can just look up a couple. Okay, that was 517. Okay, great, exclamation point 517. Cool. Done. So, that was the clear command, by the way. So that's really nice. That's easy to sort of keep track of, and that way you don't have to type in history to find the command that you don't want to have to type in because you're too lazy. Like, that defeats the purpose if you have to go to all those steps. So I just like having the number there. I'm not saying it's a must. I'm just saying I'm enjoying it. The host name, because when I SSH to some other host, then I want to remember that I'm not on the computer that I think I'm on. And that's really, really important. And that is one of those things that you can sublimate really easy, even if you have it staring at you right there. I've even color-coded my prompt in some cases, or changed the prompt in some cases, and I'll still forget. On an off day, I'll still forget. The IP address is just nice because, you know, that way you have it. The directory that you're in is, yeah, it's nice, actually. You don't have to type in PWD all the time, which is what I used to do. And I'm not saying that I'll keep this for the rest of my life. I'm just saying the way I'm working right now with lots of different, you know, I've got a Kubernetes cluster running on Pis in my closet. I've got my home server. I've got my desktop. I got my work laptop. Because of all that, this is a convenience factor. Knowing what branch I'm on is quite nice because I use Git for a lot of things. I use it at work. I use it in personal life. I use it for, you know, version tracking, all kinds of things. So just seeing that there is really useful. And then the version of Python is just nice because I it's just a nice thing to have up there. It's something that's easy to have up there. Why not? The Java one is a little bit more nuanced because I use SDKman, which is a Java package manager, essentially. I mean, it's not really, but that's kind of what it is. SDKman.io, I think. You can install different versions of Java and then switch between them. So it's a little bit like Debian's alternative package, or, you know, Fedora's alternatives package, which I think is a re-implementation of Debian's alternative package. It's just a way to tell your system, hey, I want to use this version of this application right now. SDKman has an awareness of Java that alternatives, you could do it with alternatives, you can do it with alternatives, but SDKman makes it really, really easy because you can download new versions right then and there and just switch over to it. It's really nice if you're doing that. If you're doing a lot of Java development, then it's really quite a nice feature to have. And it's just nice for me to remember half the time, like, what my system thinks my Java is, so that I don't launch NetBeans or something and then realize, oh, you're using the wrong version of Java. So that's why that's there. And yeah, that's a lot of information. It's a big old line of text. It takes vertical space in my terminal because now every prompt is, like I say, essentially two lines of text, and that's fine. Like, right now, this is very much working for me. So that's my bash RC. Sort of, that's my prompt scheme, and yeah, it's working for me well here. It, like I say, the concept for this came from the visual effects studio that I used to work at. We always had that at the top, and it was similar there as well, because you had different, like, very, very different environments that you would have to load into your terminal in order to work on a certain scene for a certain movie, because every movie would have its own environment, and so you kind of had to know where you were in your terminal, or at least it was nice to have a constant reminder that you're in the correct environment, so that when you run a command and it fails, you can look up and say, oh right, I'm on that movie, and I meant to be over in this movie, and is deceptive because it was a networked file system. You could zip over to a movie without being in its environment quite easy. So you always had to remember to switch over to the environment of that movie as well as to the directory of that movie. Very, very essential. And it worked really, really well. I implemented it in TCSH there because that's the sort of the shell that was kind of the baseline shell. And it worked well, and it became kind of a TCSH tradition for me. Like, I couldn't use TCSH if I didn't have a two-line prompt. But for some reason, I have the ability, unintentional though it may be, to separate out, like, how I use TCSH versus how I use Bash. It's really kind of weird. Or lots of things, like keyboards even. Like, for the longest time, I was running Dvorak at work and QWERTY at home, just to kind of keep myself literate on both. Now I've thrown that away and I have no idea how to use a QWERTY keyboard. Should have kept up with that. Except, I don't know, work is no longer a separate place, so it becomes complex. So that's Deep Geek's email. That's everything he had to say and everything I have to say in response. Thank you very much, Deep Geek, for the email, for the thoughts, the ideas, the revelations. I'm pretty sure I didn't know about slash Etsy issue. I could be wrong. I might have mentioned it back in the episode where we were talking about TTYs, but I don't remember it. So thank you very much for that one. And thank you, dear listener, very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time, where we'll continue our tour through the Slackware install process.